Good morning. I call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect 9:02 a.m. on Wednesday, March 9th, 2022. Present today are Representative LeBon, Vice Chair Ortiz, Co-Chair Foster, and myself, Co-Chair Merrick. We also have Representative Kronk with us today. Welcome. This morning, we will hear introductions of two pieces of legislation, HB 209, Emergency Firefighters, and HB 135, Geothermal Resources. First up is House Bill 209, Emergency Firefighters, by Representative Kronk. Representative, if you would please come to the table, put yourself on the record, and begin your presentation. And at 9:03 a.m., we are joined by Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, members of House Finance. Representative Mike Kronk, District 6, representing the Copper River Valley, Eastern Interior, up down the Yukon River to Tanana and Parks Highway. HB 209 authorizes the Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources to hire emergency firefighter personnel using general fund appropriations. By amending AS 41.15.030B, allowing the use of general funds to pay EFF personnel, they would be able to perform non-emergency work such as hazardous fuel reduction, fuel break development, fire prevention, habitat restoration, or improvement activities in fire-prone areas. In addition, this would provide economic opportunities for Alaskans to enhance public safety, to empower rural Alaskans, to responsibly manage the state's natural resources, and to protect and save human lives. Such non-emergency work could reduce the likelihood, intensity, and damage of wildland fires near populated areas and could bring significant reductions in the state cost to fight future fires. Steady employment opportunities for mostly rural-based firefighting crews would strengthen local economies, family life, and enhance public safety. By employing EFFs during non-emergency would provide training, fitness, and readiness for when a wildfire does occur. The number of EFF personnel that may be interested in applying for permanent DNR jobs would increase, which would help with recruitment. Based on legislative history, amending AS 41.15.030B, last sentence does not appear to yield any constitutional or legal problems. In 1996, the legislature added the last sentence of AS 41.15.030B to address concerns about conflicts with AS 39.25.195 of the Alaska Personnel Act. Specifically, that short-term non-permanent employees would become full-time employees. However, in 2000, the legislature amended AS 39.25.195 to allow for long-term non-permanent employees. Due to this amendment, the apparent concerns expressed by the legislature in 1996 warranting to the inclusion of the last sentence to AS 41.15.030B no longer exist. And on a personal note, when I was in college, I was an emergency firefighter. And back in those days, so that was the early 90s, there was about 70-ish crews across rural Alaska that fought fires for Alaska. And when we were done in Alaska, they were shipped out to the lower 48. And today, I think that has dwindled down to about 20. And this was a concern of mine for the last, let's 10 years. I've been fighting fires, operating my boat, or having my vehicle in there, and we've seen a really big decline in these firefighting crews. I remember specifically sitting, waiting for a helicopter to pick us up, you know, sitting with crews from Hooper Bay, Chivac, Allakaket, all across interior Alaska, and it really concerned me to realize that we are importing a whole lot of people from the lower 48 to fight our fires, and so the purpose of this bill is to keep it is to get our fire crews back in rural Alaska, but to keep our money in Alaska and use our people to fight our fires. So,
great. Thank you, Representative Kronk. And let the record reflect, at 9:03 a.m., we were joined online by Representative Thompson, and at 9:04 a.m., we were joined by Representative Wohl. Are there questions from the committee? Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Co-Chair Merrick. Thank you, Representative Kronk, for bringing this bill before us. So it seems, just by the opening statement of your sponsor statement, that right now the Department of Natural Resources does not have the power to just hire emergency personnel under the general fund. In other words, they don't have the resources or they don't have the authority to hire people.
Through the chair, they don't have the authority. And this bill addresses that. It gives them authority.
And Vice Chair, we have Norm McDonald from the Division of Forestry online that can answer questions. Yes, he'll be giving testimony momentarily.
And as a follow-up, back in the day when we used to have a lot more people doing this kind of work from Alaska, did they have the authority at that time and that authority somewhere went away?
I'm going to defer that to my staff, Sue.
Ms. Stancliff.
Good morning. For the record, Sue Stancliff, staff to Representative Kronk, through the chair, Representative Ortiz. That is correct. They did not. They could only, they had the authority then. It was cut back, and they decided to use them only under direct either high suppression, high fire danger, or incident related. And so they would not use them for mitigation or anything. They could not hire them. Since this date, I think it was 1996 was when that authority went away and they started charging incidents directly or high fire. But if there was not a high fire danger, they would have, you know, if they brought them on as high fire, and then when the, if it rained or, you know, the index changed, they would have to let them go that same day. I mean, they could be working for just a couple of days and then released, and that's counterproductive.
Representative
Ortiz. And who did you say was online that might be able to?
Norm McDonald. He'll be giving invited testimony, and then we can ask questions.
Okay, at that point.
First, Representative LeBon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess in my view of this, you would be utilizing fire crews to help prevent fires, prepare them for the fire season, because we know there's going to be a fire season. It's just how bad is the fire season. Is the hope that if it's typical for us to spend X millions of dollars fighting fires, that if we prevent some of those fires, maybe the fiscal impact is balanced out? Is that the hope, or is that a wish that probably isn't going to be realized, or do you have a view of that?
Through the chair, Representative Bonner, that is the hope, and I do believe it's going to help, you know, because just around, you know, Choke, where I live, we've done a ton of fire mitigation, create big, you know, fire lines and stuff, and this would allow our crews to not only be trained, but it will help, you know, mitigate the chance of fire or the serious fire where we're actually losing homes. So that is the goal.
Thank you. And let the record reflect, at 9:08 a.m., we were joined by Representative Josephson. I see no further questions, so we will go to that invited testimony. Mr. Norm McDonald, he is the Chief of Fire and Aviation with the Division of Forestry. Mr. McDonald, if you could place yourself on the record and please begin your testimony.
Okay, good morning, Chair and members of the House Finance Committee. For the record, my name is Norm McDonald. I'm the Chief of Fire and Aviation for the Department of Natural Resources, Division of Forestry. I'm pleased to speak to you today about the Division's support for House Bill 209. This bill is a manifestation of Alaska's need to build firefighting capacity as we face a rapidly increasing wildland fire challenge. House Bill 209 will help the Division's fire program achieve our primary missions of protecting Alaskans from wildland fire and preventing wildland fires through hazardous fuels mitigation and fire breaks. This bill also provides jobs and trainings for rural Alaskans throughout fire-prone areas of the state. As Representative Kronk explained, removing the funding impediment of Alaska Statute 4115.030 will allow DNR to use already allocated general funds to pay emergency firefighters for non-emergency fire prevention work during periods of low fire activity and shoulder seasons, both spring and fall. We have two major benefits. The first is non-emergency fire prevention work. For example, cutting trees and creating fuel breaks will provide a training ground for EFF employees to learn valuable crossover firefighting skills that will also create consistent and desirable jobs for rural Alaskans. Currently, when fire danger decreases, the crews are laid off and they must they go away until we have high fire danger again. This creates an unstable job and workforce. Most firefighters from rural villages have chosen to find other certain employment elsewhere. The second is we can leverage this workforce to drastically improve our ability to install fuel breaks around communities and prevent and moderate fires should they occur, saving potentially tens of millions of dollars in future fire suppression costs. Please note, while this bill allows general funds to be used for EFF and non-emergency tasks, we would use funds already appropriated for fuels reduction and prevention work, thus zero fiscal note. In the last 2 years, DOF has received generous allocations for hazard fuel reduction from both the state, and we receive additional federal funds for fuels mitigation. Both sources of funding could be used to pay for EFF work, which will be limited to fire response and fire prevention related activities. DOF's firefighting mission has increased dramatically as Alaska and the nation face more intense and longer fire seasons, threatening Alaskans, our homes, and property as more of us move into the fire-prone wildland-urban interface. DOF currently does not have sufficient personnel to staff for both fire protection and fuels reduction. In the past, EFF crews supplemented our permanent workforce. The lack of workforce and EFF crews, however, has led to drastic declines in their number, from approximately 56 crews in 2010 to under 8 in 2021. The division is now critically understaffed, and we rely on importing lower 48 crews to replace those important EFF resources. There are several problems with substituting EFF crews for the imported resources. The first is lower 48 crews are not readily available. We compete with every other state for these crews, and during high activity in the lower 48, we are not always able to receive that help. Response times can be as long as 72 hours. A quick, aggressive initial attack with local forces is what limits the fire size and duration, and that's what reduces the overall fire cost. The cost to import firefighters to support and support staff far exceeds using Alaska resources. For example, on a fire assignment, a 22-person Alaskan crew costs $6,500 a day, while a 22-person lower 48 crew costs more than twice that at $13,500 a day. Lower 48 crews are not familiar with Alaska fuel types and fire behavior. Alaska crews are better able to fight our fires because they know the most effective tactics for our landscape. So House Bill 209 will help us rebuild our EFF crews to create a self-sufficient Alaskan firefighting force. It will reduce the likelihood, intensity, and damage of wildland fires near populated areas and will reduce the state's firefighting costs. Where the EFF resources are the most benefit will be in our rural communities where access to contracted resources and heavy equipment is limited. Without these EFF crews, our rural communities may not receive the same level of prevention work and fire protection as roadside communities. I will say House Bill 209 dovetails perfectly with the division's request in the governor's budget to reinstate the Wildland Fire Academy. Our intent with this is to focus on workforce development and building back Alaska's wildland fire capacity. Training firefighters in rural communities will help us build our pool of recruits to work on fuels projects and fire suppression. So in short, the House Bill 209 provides secure jobs for rural-based firefighting crews. It strengthens our local economies and enhances public safety. And I'll be glad to answer any questions you might have.
Great. Thank you very much. Mr. McDonald, we have a question from Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Mr. McDonald, I just want to question the fiscal note, which is, you're saying is zero. You're adding full-time crews where there once was but now isn't. So there'll be a lot of full-time, I'm assuming year-round, firefighting crews that will be doing mitigation work when they're not fighting fires, i.e. fire breaks and cutting down fuel lines so that if a fire does encroach on a populated area, that area is protected. But this comes out of the emergency funding, I'm guessing. So wouldn't that mean less money when there's actually fires to fight? And I know in the past we've had to supplement the emergency firefighting budget when there's fire episodes. Wouldn't this be taking funds out of that program? And you know, I understand that the fire breaks are needed for populated areas, but since most wildfires, I would think, are lightning strikes, and there's, I know, thousands of them every season, you can't predict where they're going to be. So it's not necessarily going to prevent the fires. It's just going to prevent damage to populated areas. Is that correct?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Wohl, I'll try to answer a couple questions there. The first part, just to make sure I understood this correctly, to clarify, for the emergency firefighting crews, they are at call when needed, so they would not be year-round. They would be paid out of two components. The one you're referring to is a suppression component, and that's what we use when they're assigned to an incident, so a wildland fire. That would be also used if they're on a standby during high fire danger to be ready to respond to a fire. The second component that we would use is part of the fuel CIP, which was provided 2 years ago. So that's already been allocated. The funds are in place for fuels reduction work. And between that CIP and federal grants, and we have several different types of federal grants that are allocated for fuels work, and then we're anticipating in the next year or two through the infrastructure bill, there will be millions of more available to all the states for fuels reduction. That would also be available. So to be clear, the crews would not work on the suppression component. That's just for wildland firefighting, unless they're on a fire. When they're on fuels, they would be paid for either state funds, which is a pre-authorized CIP, or federal funded projects, which is through two different grants that we have available to us now. And if that answers the first part of your question, if you have a follow-up, I can try to clear that up. The second part, I think, is about the placement of the fuel breaks where these crews will work on. So you're correct. The fuels projects do not reduce the number of fire starts. But what they do and where they save us funding in the long run is the placement of the fuel breaks in strategic locations around the state. And we have several really good examples, one of them being in Fairbanks on the behind Murphy Dome fuel break we used in 2019 to protect the Murphy Dome subdivisions from a wildland fire that started in the drainage below. That fire, had it gotten in those neighborhoods and those structures, would have been in the tens of millions of dollars to protect, and that's not accounting for the lost damage to homes and infrastructure. So the placement of those fuel breaks is key. We've had success all from Fairbanks to Kenai with the fuel breaks, and that's what we're wanting to continue, is that successful model that we've used in the past.
Representative Wall.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for that answer, Mr. McDonald. Yeah, I remember the 2019 Murphy Dome incident and others. So obviously you've been successful under the current model. And, you know, I appreciate the desire to keep more people employed for longer. And you said this isn't a full-time, these aren't full-time crews. What exactly is their work schedule, I guess? Are there temporary full-time status? Or can you explain what the hours or schedule would be?
I can, through the chair, Representative Wool. Currently, they are call when needed for wildland fire only. And as Representative Kronk explained, that means when there's a fire and they're actually working on a crew and suppressing that fire or on high fire danger. Once the weather changes and it rains, they are released. So they are considered an on-call type of resource. And the current statute states we can only bring them on for fire suppression or fire preparedness, and that really limits us to the use. The intent of 209 and where this will really broaden that out is the fuels component, which we currently don't have. Our intent and what I foresee the success of this being, this dovetails really nicely into our training program. I would think our intent is it would begin training for these crews in April, have them fire ready by May 1st. That's usually when our fire season really kicks off. While they're not assigned to fires, we would have these EFF crews working on fuels projects. They're doing good work. They're protecting communities. They're building the skills that cross over to wildland fire using chainsaws, the manual labor, physical fitness, and they would be ready and available for a fire. So if a fire starts, they would transition from a fuels project directly to an initial attack or a new start to try to suppress that fire quickly. The concern I have is without having those resources available, we do rely on importing Lower 48 crews at some times during the season, and that's when we have the delay in getting resources to fires, which results in larger, more expensive, more complex type incidents.
Representative Wall.
Thank you. So these crews would start working before the fire season, training, doing fuel lines and such, and then they would they would stay on full-time for the entire season as opposed to just on-call for fire emergencies. And then the funding source would switch when they're working on fires and when they're working on fuel lines.
That's correct. While we have funding, and right now we do, there is a lot of federal funding available and the state CIP to do this work. So this is one of those opportunities where we strike while the iron is hot. So again, the intent would be to have them working shoulder seasons, both spring and fall, and working on fuels projects during fire season, which means they'd be ready and available on a really short notice for a quick initial attack or initial response to a wildland fire. So I think the second part of your question was while they're on the fuels project, they would be funded and paid through that allocated funding for that fuels project, whether it's a state CIP or a federal funded project. When they got assigned to an incident, their charge code changes, and they would charge to that fire number and be on that suppression component.
Yes, follow up.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Thank you for that information. That's very useful. So if the funding source, the federal funds or whatever the fuel remediation funds, if they ran out, then that would limit how much.
Am I still on, or did I lose you?
Can you hear me? Mr. McDonald?
Mr. McDonald? Can you hear us? We'll come back to Mr. McDonald. Representative LeBon.
Well, I guess my question for Mr. McDonald will be on hold, but I had an observation. Question, accommodation, observation. We have a lot of dead trees out there, the spruce, beetle, kill, and I think most of it is in Kenai, but not exclusively, and Matsu has a lot of dead trees. Is part of this program aimed at reducing that fire risk in some manageable level? I know there's way too many to go and cut them all down, but how does the dead tree factor into this?
Representative Kronk.
Through the chair, Representative LeBon. That is definitely a norm question for sure, but I think part of the building fire breaks is to remove those fire hazards, which are dead trees. And I think the beauty of this bill, we've been talking with the departments, is the ability for the departments to work together. Like in the Matsu Valley, we know that they're trying to actually harvest those trees. They're trying to get logging companies in there to remove those trees to be used. Like there's a guy out there that's actually milling that lumber and building homes with it. So I think this is a little bigger than that, but I know where the reduction part is, it would be removing those dead trees.
As a follow-up, Madam Chair. First year down here 4 years ago, we arrived with a supplemental budget ask for spending a lot of money putting out fires that prior summer. So you don't know what kind of fire season you're going to have. So if this is an insurance policy to try to keep the extreme from happening, then I think it's money well spent. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative LeBon. Mr. McDonald, are you there?
I am. I'm not sure what happened there. It sounds like I dropped off for a little bit, but I'm back if you can hear me.
Yes, we can hear you fine. Did you hear Representative LeBon's question?
I'm sorry, I did not. It went blank on my end for about 30 seconds, and then it came back. So if you could please repeat, I'll try to answer.
Okay. Representative LeBon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the question was about dead trees and spruce beetle kill. I know Kenai and Matsu have a whole bunch of that. Is that a targeted use of this program to try to reduce that risk?
Through the chair, Representative LeBron, the beetle kill is one of our targets. We do a couple different types of what we call fuel breaks. We do the actual traditional, like a swath through the trees, and you kind of look at it from there. It looks like a right away. But we also do what we call shaded fuel breaks. And then the beetle kill, that's kind of a successful model. We've used that around specific, like tactical areas. There's a project around the university down there in Kenai right now, it's a perfect example of that, where they're all the dead and down is being removed, and then we limb up the green, healthy trees, which provides a healthy forest, but also reduces the fire hazard. So we have a couple different strategies we use, but in the beetle kill, that thinning or reducing of the dead and down is one of them that we do use.
Yes, follow-up?
And as a follow-up to that answer, this program would allow you to get a little bit ahead of that in an effective manner. Would that be a true statement?
Through the chair, Representative LeBlanc, that's correct.
Great, thank you. We're going to go back to Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Mr. McDonald, you mentioned striking while the iron's hot, no pun intended, but you're basically saying that there's federal funds and CIP funds that are available for the shoulder seasons for fire crews to do fuel remediation. If that funding were to dry up or go away, then it wouldn't, this, you'd still have firefighting funds or emergency funds separate. And that would pay for the crews to actually fight the fire, and those two funds wouldn't cross over. So it sounds like what you're saying is, and what this bill does, and maybe this is for Representative Kronk, it allows the one kind of fund to use to pay for the crews for non-firefighting purposes. But if the funds were to dry up, then it wouldn't affect the funding source for the firefighting itself.
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, that's a true statement. If for some reason the fuels funding went away, this does not change the firefighting component. That would still be allowed and authorized through this. That part of it would not change at all.
Last question.
Yes, Representative Wohl.
Thank you. I always say that, but so the funding now to remediate fuel. Who's doing that if the fire crews are, my understanding is the emergency firefighting personnel are used to fight fires, and this bill would allow that the fuel funding to be used for the same crews. Who's doing the fuel remediation now, since this bill hasn't passed yet? Is that an issue?
Mr. McDonald? Representative Kronk, do you have the answer to that question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I could take a stab at it. I'm going to guess a lot of it is mechanical removal of stuff, but that's, I'm just throwing that as a guess. I'm not sure. I know we have a lot of fire breaks that were mechanically removed, you know, using, you know, filler bunchers and doing that, but Mr. McDonald would be the one.
Mr. McDonald, are you available?
I am, and I'm sorry, I don't know why it keeps going blank. I don't think it's on my side, but if it happens again, you'll know why. It goes quiet for a second, then back on.
Okay, well, luckily this is Representative Wohl's last question.
Okay.
Thank you. My question was, if the funding for fire breaks is not allowed to be spent with EFF personnel, who's doing the fire breaks now? And this bill would allow the fire crews to do both fire breaks and fuel remediation, as well as fighting fires. So who's doing it now, assuming that this bill is what will allow that to happen?
Yeah, Representative Wohl, and I'm sorry, through the chair, Representative Wohl, we have our plan, even with this bill, is to use a multifaceted approach to this. We have we use private contracts and local contractors for some of the work. There's places where they're the best resource or tool for the job. We do have our agency crews. There's three of those that the state has while they're not on fires, although that's less and less time available for fuels because our fire seasons, both in Alaska and the Lower 48, are longer. They do fuels work. We have two contract crews, one with TCC and Chugach-Mute. We use them for both fires and fuels, but that's just not enough resources in the state to do both for the fire seasons we have and fuels. So this would just augment what we already have in place and we'll continue using.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. McDonald. We appreciate you being here with us today. With that, I'm going to open public testimony on House Bill 209. Is there anyone in the room or online wishing to testify on House Bill 209? Hearing and seeing none, I will close public testimony. And with that, we will take a brief at ease. House Finance back on the record. We have amendment number one by Representative Laban. Representative Laban.
Madam Co-Chair, I wish to move amendment number one.
I'll object for the purpose of discussion. Representative Laban.
Amendment number one provides for an effective date, and the effective date will be immediate upon passage of this bill.
Thank you. I will remove my objection. Is there further objection? Hearing none. Amendment number one has passed. And with that, we'll take a brief at ease. House Finance back on the record. With that, is there a motion on House Bill 209?
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 209, version 32-LS0929/A from committee as amended with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note, and authorize legislative legal services to make conforming changes.
Is there an objection? Hearing none, House Bill 209 has been moved from House Finance Committee. Brief at ease. House Finance back on the record. Next, we have House Bill 135, Geothermal Resources, by the Governor. Today, we have Sean Clifton, Policy and Program Specialist with the Division of Oil and Gas. You'll be presenting this bill for the administration. Welcome to House Finance. If you'd place yourself on the record and begin your presentation.
Good morning. For the record, I am Sean Clifton, Policy and Program Specialist for the Division of Oil and Gas. On the line, I also have Haley Payne, Deputy Director for the Division of Oil and Gas, and David LePayne, who is the new Director for the Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys. This is our brief agenda for the day. Hopefully, we can cover this in here in the next 20 minutes. we'll briefly go over the purpose of the bill, cover DNR's geothermal leasing history, go over the summary for the sectional analysis, and then go over some of the details in the sectional analysis. And we also provided a lot of supplemental information just in case some questions come up or if you all want to reference that later. So the main purpose of the bill is to modernize Alaska's geothermal exploration program. And the reason why we're doing this now is that, well, we haven't had a whole lot of interest and experience in geothermal leasing and exploration on Alaska state lands. And we have done quite a bit of updating and revising our statutes for oil and gas. And meanwhile, our geothermal statutes have kind of languished. And so we are bringing that stuff up to date so that we can hopefully encourage some new exploration and development in geothermal projects and get some new resources, especially to our rural communities, and create some more jobs.
Great, thank you. And let the record reflect, we were joined by Representative Edgman at 9:35.
And so, like I said, we are aligning our geothermal licensing program through this bill with our existing oil and gas exploration license program, which has been receiving quite a bit of attention over the last few years. And we think that that's going to be a very good and successful model for geothermal as well. One of the big things is that it provides the companies a bit more time to to identify improved resources, and it expands the amount of acreage that they have to explore secured within that license, which is very important, especially for geothermal resources, because geothermal systems typically cover very large areas. And then we are also reforming our definitions for geothermal resources to focus on commercial use. It has in the past been implied in the statute, but we want to make it clear that DNR doesn't have any interest in requiring private users of geothermal resources to be regulated. Any questions?
I see none. Please continue.
So as you can see here, this brief history, DNR actually hasn't had that much attention to geothermal resources. We've held three lease sales between 1983 and 2008 in the Mount Spur area. We've had some leases issued back in 2008. We did have some drilling, and we actually have some public data available on our website for that. And then in 2013, we did have a tract issued in a lease sale for Augustine Island. And that's about it. And now we have two geothermal prospecting permits issued, again, for the Mount Spur area, and we have another application for the Augustine Island that we're reviewing. And one provision in this bill is to extend those prospecting permits and include them in the exploration licensing program that would be enabled by this legislation so that they can get the benefit of that extended time period. Any questions?
Yes.
Representative Josephson.
Back one slide on page four. Through the chair, you're Mr. Clifton, correct?
Yes, sir.
All right. Mr. Clifton, on this definitional reform, I guess what I'm struggling with is I don't have a visual sense, based on lack of experience, of what it would look like to stop regulating domestic, non-commercial, or small-scale industrial use. I don't know the impact of that. I don't know what it looks like on the ground. I just don't have any sense of it at all. Can you help me with that?
Yes. Through the chair, Representative Jefferson, we are not currently regulating any geothermal activity on state lands at the present time. And the commercial use aspect is something that we're seeking to make explicit, but it's already implied under the current statutes. We just want to make that more explicit, that DNR does not want to interfere with people who are trying to use hot springs or ground source heat pumps or things like that to heat their cabins or potentially even generate electricity. We want to make it clear that we are focusing on commercial grade resources, which are typically much deeper and much more expensive to develop, like many millions of dollars to develop. And you know, it's a separate situation. It doesn't change anything for present development.
Thank you.
Great, thank you. Please continue.
All right. This is an overview of DNR's leasing and permitting process. First, we receive an application, and then we issue a call for competing proposals. And that's a typical public notice, and we seek any other companies that might want to bid for the same prospect that we've received an application for. If we do receive any interest in that, then we have to issue a lease sale, a competitive lease sale. Same thing for oil and gas. This is why we hold regional lease sales for oil and gas activities. And if we don't receive any competing proposals, then we just go ahead and issue a best interest finding for the prospecting permit. And so we issue a preliminary finding and put that out for public notice. Throughout that process, we also do interagency reviews so that other state and federal agencies that may have interest in that, as well as boroughs, can participate. participate in that process with us, and we actually solicit their participation before the preliminary finding is even issued. And then once that preliminary finding is issued, we receive comments, revise the finding as needed, depending on what kind of comments we may receive, and then we issue a final finding. And then after that final finding is issued, then we will, as long as the applicant is satisfied with the terms, we'll issue the permit.
Representative Josephson.
Chair, Mr. Clifton, what is the notice and opportunity to be heard by the public on the lease sale proposals? Can the public speak at a public hearing and say, we don't like this lease sale?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, we don't hold public hearings. We issue public notices and solicit for written comments. And those comments can come in the form of a letter, an email. Occasionally, I've received comments that were dictated to me over the phone, but usually it's a written comment sent in the form of a letter or an email. We don't hold public hearings for that sort of thing.
Okay. Representative Josephson.
Is that how DNR typically does other proposals on lease sales of this nature on state land?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, yes. The public hearings are not required under the statute or regulations. So it's just a public notice and opportunity for comment. We're not required to hold public hearings for those things.
Thank you.
Thank you. Please continue.
All right, here is our sectional summary. A lot of it is redundant or overlapping, and I'm not going to touch on all 18 sections today, especially since we're a little short on time. I'm going to hit the highlights, though. If you all have reviewed this already, do you have any specific questions in any of these sections?
I see no questions.
All right. So section 2 is our private use exemption. A prospecting license or lease is not required under the section to explore for, develop, or use geothermal resources if the geothermal resource is intended for domestic, non-commercial, or small-scale industrial use. And this is what I was talking about, where we're explicitly excluding private geothermal users from a requirement to apply for a license or a lease.
Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So you say non-commercial, but then small-scale industrial, which obviously is commercial. How do you differentiate commercial from small-scale industrial? I mean, one is small-scale industrial is commercial, so how do you split that?
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, that is a great question, and that is so far not explicitly defined, and we kind of want that vague for a reason. So, please let me explain. So we want to have some flexibility in order to assess the nuances of a situation. Say, for example, a fish processing plant or logging processing plant is, has some sort of remote operation going on, and they happen to notice that there's a hot spring, and they are able to tap into that and develop some power generation for the purpose of fueling their plant. And then they also have some remote cabins nearby. So maybe they're generating, 10 megawatts or whatever to fuel their operation, and they're selling, 0.8 megawatts to their neighboring cabins. That sort of hypothetical scenario seems like the kind of situation where it would not be in the state's best interest or DNR's interest to try and regulate them and extract very minuscule royalties. I mean, that would be a small-scale industrial and really not worth our time and not in the best interest of anyone.
Representative Wolf.
Thank you. So when you say regulate, do you mean for geothermal purposes, mostly selling power say, charging royalties, whereas if the user, the processor, used all the geothermal energy for just internal consumption, whether to heat their facility or power their machines, which is probably in some cases not a trivial amount of power, but and if they're not selling it, is that where you sort of draw the line with commercial, even if they're using it internally and not, you know, sort of for, you know, displacing costs that they'd otherwise have?
Through the chair, Representative Wallace. So part of the problem with trying to define these things is that we don't have any experience in regulating this sort of thing as a state. There aren't a whole lot of examples of this sort of industrial or commercial operation really anywhere in the world. I mean, most of this stuff is either explicitly commercial, like being run by a power company, or being run by the government of, you know, like Iceland or something like that. And so trying to minutely define these things, we would necessarily have to be arbitrary just because we don't know. And so that is why we want to leave it open for either specifying later on in regulations or to be able to handle those nuances in the context of a best interest finding and leave it up to our commissioner to define at the time that the situation comes up.
Great, thank you. Any further questions? We're going to have to wrap up as we have 4 at 10. Mr. Clifton, I apologize that we didn't give you more time, but we will certainly have you back soon. With that, this concludes our agenda for this morning. Our next meeting is this afternoon at 1:30. We will consider House Bill 110, age for nicotine e-cigarette, tax e-cigarette, House Bill 104, motor fuel tax, and if there's time, Senate Bill 33, seafood product development tax credit. And with that, at 9:54 a.m., we are adjourned. Thank you. Good afternoon. I call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect it is 1:34 p.m. on Wednesday, March 9th, 2022. Present today are Representative LeBon, Vice Chair Ortiz, Co-Chair Foster, Representative Rasmussen, Representative Josephson, Representative Wohl, Representative Johnson. Online we have Representative Thompson, and in the room we have Representative Hannon with us today. Thank you for being here. I'm Co-Chair Merrick. This afternoon we will consider three pieces of legislation: House Bill 110, age for nicotine e-cigarette tax e-cigarette, HB 104, motor fuel tax vehicle registration fee, and SB 33, seafood product development tax credit. So first up we have House Bill 110, age for nicotine, by Representative Hannon. Welcome back. If you could come up to the table. We last heard this bill on May 7th, 2021. And amendments were due to my office originally May 11th, and then again at 1 p.m. yesterday. We have 11 amendments. And with that, would you like an opening statement, Representative?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Yes, Representative Hannon, House District 33, which you are currently sitting in. To reprise and remind you, House Bill 110 would add into our current existing taxation structure on tobacco under other tobacco products, vape cigarettes. The last time that Alaska addressed tobacco taxes, nicotine taxes, vaping really wasn't a thing over 15 years ago. And because our statutes specify cigarettes and then delineates other tobacco products listing snuff, chew, etc., because vaping didn't exist, it's not listed, therefore it's not taxed. This bill would institute the current taxation structure that exists onto vaped cigarette products, e-cigs, vape, etc. It would also change the smoking age to 21 in Alaska in compliance with a federal law that is in a place. That law was changed in 2019, and states have till December 2022 to come into compliance or risk their tobacco settlement revenues up to 10% of those for not being in compliance with tobacco, federal tobacco law. I believe that young people are more accepting of e-cigarettes as an entry way into being addicted to nicotine, and I think tobacco taxes discourage them from doing it, and I think that we should be taxing it. So with that, you've got a lot of work before you.
Great, thank you. Anything from the committee before we entertain amendments? Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Representative Hannon, good to see you again and welcome back. And I just sort of want to get on the record and stay out front. I support your efforts for the tax, and I'm looking forward to the hearty discussion. Obviously, as you know, with other bills, there's other issues in the bill that we may push against that I know you had nothing to do with, so please don't take it personally. that being said, let's proceed.
Well, that's a great sign, thank you. Representative Josephson.
Ready to rumble.
I apologize.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, the other body, and I know we can't talk about the other body on the floor generally, but the other body has concluded so far that the delivery instrument, the metal and plastic, commonly called the device, I guess, should be taxed as well. It's in their bill. Do you take a position on that as a policy matter?
Well, if, through the chair, as a new technology, one of the things that we risk is crafting a definition that can be walked around or worked around. And my staff and I, when we requested the bill, intended to tax what are considered integrated devices. So there are some devices that are in essence proprietary. You need to own my device to be able to smoke my cartridges. You know, what some of the earliest types of those were available only through internet sales, and you had to buy your cartridges from that same company. Now, of course, an industry has developed where there's a whole device section industry, and pod separate from that. Maybe the parts are interchangeable, maybe they're not. The definition that I've used in my version of the bill, the House version currently, doesn't incorporate as broadly all the device options that there are in the industry, but does ones that are integrated. So if you have to have that pod with this device, then it is incorporated in the definition I use. The Senate has, excuse me, the other body is using a definition that is broader in an attempt to capture all the devices that are on the market, whether they are proprietary to my pod being used in that device.
Thank you. I see nothing further. With that, we will move to amendments. We have amendment number one by Representative Thompson. Representative Thompson, is there a motion?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move the amendment number one.
I will object for the purpose of discussion. Go ahead, Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. In the room with me, or there, I'm not with me, I'm in my apartment, but is my staff, Tom Wright, to answer any technical questions that might come up. Amendment number one addresses the smoking age of 21. Alaskans are considered to be adults at 18. And at age 18, you can be drafted into the Army, be issued a weapon, be sent to war, and be killed. And I feel like that we're overstepping, even the federal government is overstepping the right of a person to decide what they want to do. For many, many, many years, social issues like the smoking age were all left up to the states. And I feel like we're overstepping this a bit. You do have a legal memo in your packet that speaks about the fact that the federal government is making it a law for 21 years of age. And we could possibly lose federal funding if we don't comply with their exact same age in that they have. That isn't true yet, but if this does become a reality that it would affect our ability to receive grants, then we definitely would need to come back and change this. But I feel at this time that we're infringing on an adult's right to do things, and that's why we are bringing amendment number one to the House committee.
Great. Thank you, Representative Thompson. We have questions from Representatives Rasmussen and then Josephson, and then Wohl.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, and through the Chair. Just in reading through your memo, it looks like we would be at risk starting December 21st, 2022. Do you know how much funding is at risk if we get through this session without changing anything? Obviously, the next legislative session, we pass this deadline, and I'm not sure that we would have the votes to call ourselves back into session. So just curious what we may be on the hook for financially.
I'm not aware right now of what it would be or if they actually would institute that requirement. And that I don't have anything more on that. I don't know if my staff, Tom Wright, has or not.
I can speak to that. Stephanie Andrews, staff to Representative Hannon, Representative Rasmussen through the chair. Legislative Finance has told our office that it is has been for the past few years about $30 million that we put up to risk of federal substance use disorder grants, and that we put up to risk 10% of that for if we do not comply with the federal T21 law. So therefore, we're putting at risk approximately $3 million in federal grants by not complying with federal law.
Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Through the Chair, I tend to agree with the sponsor that we allow people to enlist at 18, and I feel like as much as we can maintain our state's rights, we should try to do so. So I do believe I'll be supporting this amendment.
Thank you, Representative Rasmussen. Representative Josephson. Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I guess this amendment brings out my libertarian streak a little bit, and I do agree with the sponsor that if 18, you're an adult, which is what we all recognize in this country, you're an adult, you can vote, as the sponsor said, you can be drafted, you can go to war, you can be issued a gun, you can be basically licensed to kill. You can also buy a gun. You can buy an AR-15 at 18. So we're trusting people to buy heavy weaponry at 18. If you're committed of a crime, you go to adult jail. You don't go to under 21 jail. You go to the adult jail, prison, which is serious. You can adopt a child at 18. You can rent a car. You can move out of the house. You can buy a house. You can do all kinds of things at 18. And I don't support smoking. It's an unhealthy habit. Have I done it in my life? Yeah, I have. And I've quit. But I think 18 should mean something. And most countries don't, you know, I don't want to talk about what other countries do, but most of them don't have a 21 tobacco age. They don't have a 21 drinking age, too. Most countries in the world have an 18 drinking age as well, which the federal government also raised to 21 and told states if they don't comply, they'll lose highway funding, and they're doing the same thing here. So, you know, I understand the power of the purse, and we are susceptible to it, but I believe that if you're an adult at 18 and you can vote and get married and buy guns and go to adult prison, you should be able to smoke a cigarette at your wedding.
Thank you, Representative Josephson, and then Representative LeBron.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I only wanted to speak because I can tell we're in discussion more than questions. I wish we had a gun bill before us. That would make me very happy, but we don't have a gun bill before us. And I don't subscribe as much to, I think it's called dual federalism, as the standard model, which is the supremacy clause and an understanding that the federal government is supreme. If we challenge the law, we challenge the law. But certainly when it comes to states' rights, the right to be permissible, more permissible as regards tobacco, isn't something I want to jealously guard. So I oppose the amendment.
Thank you. Representative LeBron.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I do support the amendment, but I have a question that maybe the maker of the bill, Representative Hanna, could answer. We've heard about the military connection. You can join the military, go off and fight a war at 18. Does the military have a policy regarding using tobacco products under the age of 21?
Yes, and the policy is they cannot.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions? Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. And just on that last question about the military, if the military is stationed in a country with a tobacco age lower than 21, and are soldiers allowed to smoke in, you know, on the streets of Germany or something like that?
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, would we ask the Department of Defense to make sure we were crafting a bill that complied with federal law? The response was the federal smoking age of 21 or tobacco use age of 21 was in place in all U.S. military posts and locations. So now, on the streets of Bangkok, if you're not on a military post, does the U.S. MP ticketing you? That was not addressed. And I feel compelled to make sure, because you referenced it being 18, there's a couple others saying 18. The amendment as proposed does not change the age to 18, it changes it to 19.
Thank you. Let the record reflect we are joined by Representative Edgman at 1:48 p.m. Is there anything? Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, and through the chair. Could the maker of the amendment speak to the rationale for the age of 19 instead of 18?
No, I feel like this is Representative Thompson again. Through the co-chair, Representative Rasmussen, 19 is what basically it's been, and it seemed to have been accepted, but I would not argue about the 18 at all. If you want to know back into history, back in the late 60s, early 70s, there was a precedent set at one time that we used to have the drinking age at 19 years of age in Alaska. Federal government came out and said, you're not going to get any highway dollars if you don't move it to 21. So we did. But at the same time, we gave a exception. If you were 19 years of age when that passed to move to 21, you were grandfathered in. So bartenders had to look at your license to see if you were 20 years old, you could still have a beer or whatever happened in those times. So it's an interesting conundrum that we're at. Looking at 18, you can be not just joined, you could be drafted into the military and forced to do these things. And so you're an adult in everybody's mind, except in the smoking age. So I don't have anything else on that. I don't know if we lost any money when we let people drink before they turned 21 through that period of time or not.
Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, and through the Chair. So just for clarification, this amendment restores the current smoking age of 19 in state statute. It just brings it back to where it currently stands.
Correct.
Thank you. Representative Josephson.
Well, just a comment for the body. I'm remembering from teaching constitutional law that the case relative to alcohol is called Dole versus South Dakota, or really South Dakota.